From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast.
This is the China in the World podcast. My name is Tong Zhao. I'm happy to invite here today Dr. David Santoro, who is the director and the senior fellow of nuclear policy programs at Pacific Forum. Before joining Pacific Forum, David worked on nuclear policy issues in France, Australia, Canada, and the UK, and he specializes in strategic and deterrence issues, as well as non-proliferation and nuclear security, with a regional focus on the Asia-Pacific and Europe. David, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Given that you have a real expertise on Asia-Pacific security, I have to say that I'm personally very concerned about the two big powers, US, China, and their security relationship in the future. After the Trump administration released several important defense and security documents, strategies. Clearly, China was portrayed as a primary rival in the long-term future. And also, this new nuclear posture review report was released earlier this year, in which there were some elements that seem particularly worrisome to Chinese experts and officials. So maybe we should start with this new NPR report. What do you think this report gets right about US-China nuclear relationship? And are there any policy solutions that you think are problematic?
I think, like you've correctly pointed out, you cannot look at the nuclear posture review in isolation. I think it's part of a broader trend in US-China relations, where we are moving towards a more competitive environment, security-wise, and also in the economic realm. And you've pointed out that there are other documents. So I think the frame document, the document of reference, is the National Security Strategy, which the administration published in December 2017, which makes very clear that it regards China and Russia as strategic competitors. And the administration also has concerns about others, particularly the rogue regimes, North Korea, what the administration calls the rogue regimes, North Korea and Iran. So the frame document is the National Security Strategy. A month later, the National Defense Strategy was also published and also portrayed China and Russia as strategic competitors. The key theme that was expressed in those two documents is we are in a world where it's going to be focused primarily on major power competition. And the NPR was published just a month after, in February 2018. And so it follows those two documents where, again, the focus is major power competition. And unsurprisingly, the two powers that are featured, you know, quite strongly in the review are Russia and China. And, you know, more talks about major power competition. So the administration increasingly looks at China as a competitor, not an adversary. They've been very careful in portraying China as a competitor, not an adversary. So this is really the new world that the administration sees itself. Having said that, when it comes to nuclear issues, I think the administration is much more worried about Russia, which, as you know, has a much bigger arsenal than China, and has had over the past few months and years a very different nuclear behavior than China. The United States has issues over arms control with Russia. on the INF treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Obviously, the Crimea situation has complicated U.S.-Russia relations. Mm-hmm. And so the United States, again, is primarily worried about Russia. It also worries very much about North Korea, which also, as you know, has been developing a nuclear arsenal in violation of its non-proliferation commitments. China features, you know, as I said, quite high in the nuclear posture review. And in some ways, it is lumped together with Russia as a major power that the United States needs to contend with. But it's not regarded as a primary problem from a nuclear perspective. So even though the nuclear posture review regards Russia and China together, it also worries much more about other powers, and notably Russia and North Korea. Now, this may not be as evident as it seems when you read the report, because again, China features quite heavily. Mm-hmm. But I think in practice, it's very clear that the administration worries more about Russia and North Korea than about China.
But do you worry about any specific implications for future U.S.-China nuclear relationship as a result of this nuclear posture review, given that, as you said, the main focus was on Russia, but maybe China was the collateral damage, meaning even though the U.S. clearly wants to take a few measures to address the Russian nuclear threat, including by emphasizing small-yield tactical nuclear weapons development, but that will also have implications for China too. Do you think, from the Chinese perspective, watching Russia investing a lot in all kinds of new nuclear weapons technology and U.S. now re-emphasizing on tactical nuclear weapons, do you think China will react? In what way do you think the DoD has factored this possible Chinese reaction into their strategy?
So I think you're quite right when you say that the new low-yield weapon that the United States proposes to develop are primarily targeting Russia. And in the conversations that I've had, very clearly U.S. officials have said that this is a decision that was made with Russia in mind, not other countries. To some extent, North Korea as well, but China was not factored in. It was predominantly to respond to a Russia problem. Now, I think you're right that, you know, from Beijing, when you look at this, you think, well, to what extent does that not include China? What does that mean for China? My own sense is that China has basically two choices. On the one hand, it can say, all right, it's about competition. Maybe we are not the primary target, but we are going to be a target. Therefore, we need to change our policy. We need to maybe increase our arsenal, get rid of no first use, you know, completely change our policy and engage in active competition with the United States. That's option number one. Option number two is to say, well, why don't we reach out to the United States and actually engage in a dialogue to try and make sure that, you know, we better understand each other, that we show that we are not Russia, that we are not North Korea, that our nuclear policy has been consistent since 1964, that we still believe in no first use, you know, all these things that would help at least improve the U.S.-China relationship in the nuclear sphere. And so that's option number two. Mm. And this is, as you know, an option that the United States has been pushing for quite a long time, encouraging China to get into a dialogue, you know, not to agree on everything, but at least to make sure that there are fire breaks on the nuclear problem.
If China is willing to take the option number two, in other words, to engage with the United States on nuclear issues, what should be the basis for the bilateral engagement? Because this new NPR report clearly dropped the reference to maintaining strategic stability relationship with China. So what does that mean? is strategically still the foundation of the bilateral relationship? Is the U.S. still committed to maintaining the so-called mutually assured destruction relationship with China? If so, is this relationship sustainable in the future, given all these new non-nuclear technologies, right? Missile defense, conventional precision strike weapons, even cyber weapons, they can all undermine your enemy's nuclear retaliation potential. Given all these new threats to nuclear systems and their enabling capabilities, how can we sustain this mutually assured destruction relationship into the future?
So I think one of the key questions before the nuclear posture review, and one that we discussed, you know, for many months before the review was out, was whether or not the concept of strategic stability was still going to be the organizing principle, not only between the United States and China, but also between the United States and Russia. And like you mentioned, this has been the organizing principle since the 2010 NPR, Nuclear Posture Review, released by the Obama administration. It turns out that this NPR, like you mentioned, abandoned that concept. I think it got maybe two or three vague references in the document, but nothing very, very substantive. Instead, the focus has been, it's all about deterrence, it's all about competition. And so it's not very clear that there is an organizing principle now. For what I know, we've moved from strategic stability to strategic competition. Now, that being said, the document makes clear that the Nuclear Posture Review makes clear that it still wants not only some form of stability with nuclear stability with Russia and China, mm-hmm. that it does not mean to, I think the word is undermine or upset the strategic balance, and that it also wants to engage in dialogue with Russia and China. And so even though that concept of strategic stability was abandoned, there is language in the report that suggests that stability or seeking some form of stability with China and Russia is one of the goals. So how do we do that now? I think, and you've rightly pointed out that it's not just about nuclear anymore. We have not only offensive systems, but also defensive systems, missile defense, and new domains of engagement, notably space, cyber, and I think, you know, the future is going to be even more complicated with 3D printing, artificial intelligence, and all these new emerging technologies. So my own sense is that the best way to try and engage in, to try and reach some level of stability would be for the US and China to start discussing those issues and sitting down at the table at the official level to do that. Now, as you know, the Pacific Forum and China, we've engaged in track 1.5, so-called track 1.5, basically unofficial dialogue to try and make sense of how we could go about it. And I think we've made a lot of progress. But I don't think that you can do that only at the unofficial level. I think there's a role for official dialogue to take place to make sure that, you know, the Chinese and U.S. governments are in sync on how to promote stability.
Right. I agree. You know, we need to discuss these threats from new non-nuclear military technologies. But is there any real hope that we can reach real agreement or common ground on these issues? You know, in the Cold War, the nuclear equation was simple. You can calculate your enemy's nuclear strike power by understanding whether your own nuclear retaliation capability is assured or not. Now, later on, there was this new variable of missile defense. It makes the equation a little more complicated, but it's still manageable to some extent. You can still make those calculations. And therefore, maybe the two sides could still reach a basic agreement on how much missile defense can be justified without disturbing the nuclear balance. But now we have many more new variables, right? Conventional precision weapons, cyber weapons. How do you quantify and qualify each other's cyber capability that might be able to undermine each other's nuclear command control system? Space-based surveillance technologies, as you said, AI, which can be used to monitor and detect, monitor and track each other's nuclear mobile vehicles or even nuclear submarines undersea. So is there any real hope if we look into the mid to long-term future that we can really make any basic agreement across these different technology domains?
So I think you're right that we live in a much more complex security environment than we were in the Cold War. And I think you're right that, again, it was much easier to when the only worry, quote unquote, was nuclear weapons and maybe some missile defense. Now, I should point out, though, that at the time, it did not look easy when, you know, nuclear weapons first came to the fore. People didn't say, well, it's very easy. This is how it's going to work. This is going to be the organizing principle. It took some time. As a matter of fact, as you know, nuclear weapons were first invented in the Second World War. And right after the Second World War, that's when, you know, basically they started to play a role in interstate relationships. It still took about 12 years between 1945 and 1957 to come up with the concept of deterrence. So it took a long time to try and find a way to promote some stability. So during that time, the world looked very complicated. We did not have an answer on how to maintain deterrence. I know that right now, retrospectively, we look at the Cold War and think, well, this was actually very simple. You know, we could maintain a balance fairly easily. I can assure you that if you read some of the Cold War historical books and reports, at the time, it did not look that easy. Mm. So I think that, I mean, all you said, I think I agree with. It's true that today is, you know, we're in a much more complicated era with many more technologies to deal with. But I think that we have to accept that we are not going to find a solution just right away. So is there any hope to do it? I think there is. I think it starts by sitting down and trying to make sense of those technologies, of where we are. I think that the traditional way to manage stability has been arms control, as you know. And I think there is still today a role for arms control. My own personal hope is that when the New START Treaty expires in 2021, that the United States and Russia will extend it. I think it's still valuable. Having said that, I am not convinced that to deal with, you know, what is going on in the space and cyber domains, to manage all these new emerging technologies, traditional arms control measures will are the way to go to manage those systems. I think we're more likely to be successful if we establish rules of the roads or maybe some norms on how to manage those technologies. So it I guess what I'm getting at is that the solution is not necessarily traditional arms control, but maybe some rules of the road, some normatic behavior to manage those technologies. Now, I don't know how this will look like, but I think we're more likely to be successful if we establish a framework of behavior around those technologies. And I think that begins by dialogue. I think China and the United States are not talking to each other, we cannot establish those rules of the road.
Let's maybe delve a little bit into one of those technologies, which is missile defense. You, as a nuclear expert, who spend a lot of time on these issues, do you think, in general, for the United States, missile defense should be further enhanced? And if so, again, do you have any specific ideas about how to mitigate potential Chinese and or Russian reactions?
So The short answer is yes. I think missile defense have a role. I don't think they are a silver bullet. And I'm not, this is not a play on word. I really mean this. I mean, this, they can be complementary to a deterrence policy. They are not gonna, they're not gonna be foolproof to stop a missile coming from North Korea, but I think they are part of the architecture that should be deployed to enhance U.S. security, and for that matter, the security of regional U.S. allies, notably South Korea and Japan. Now, as you said, the problem is that as the United States is increasing quantity and quality of its missile defense systems, the risk is that this would impact this would have an impact on China. And so far, it's been U.S. policy that the goal was to not upset the strategic balance, not only with China in Asia, but also with Russia in Europe. And as far as I know, it is still the goal. And as I said, the Nuclear Posture Review still talks about maintaining some strategic balance with China and with Russia. That being said, in theory, shortly after the Nuclear Posture Review, the release of the so-called missile defense review should have been done. Now, for some reason, and I don't know why, the missile defense review hasn't been released. My expectation is that the missile defense review will follow what the nuclear posture review is saying, which is, you know, the strategic balance between the U.S., Russia, and U.S. and China should be maintained, and therefore missile defense should not be targeting those countries. But right now the missile defense isn't out, so we'll have to see what it says exactly to be sure. But in terms of ways, in terms of what can be done for the United States to reassure that its missile defense development and deployments are not going to upset the balance, I think, you know, consultations is something that could happen. Maybe even, you know, visits is something that we could envision. I don't think that Beijing has been too receptive in terms of visits or consultations vis-a-vis missile defense. But the United States has tried to engage Beijing and similarly Moscow on ways that they, you know, it could reassure them. I don't think it's been so successful so far, but there have been attempts again to engage in consultations and specific system visits.
Well, at Pacific Forum, I know you have helped organize and contribute to various Track 2, Track 1.5 level dialogues between U.S. and China on nuclear issues and overall security issues. What are the overall lessons that you can draw from this experience? Do you think trust has been built in this process of long-term extensive dialogues? What you have done right to help build confidence, and what are the areas that still lack important progress? What can we do to address those issues in the future?
So has it been successful? Yes, absolutely. And it's been, I think we are dialogue number 12, so 12 years of engagement. Very successful. Not only in is developing personal relations with officials and think tank, you know, experts, and this is very important for, you know, because we are able to explain each other's policy and better understand each other, better trust each other. It doesn't mean we agree, but at least we're able to explain specific policy development, specific policy, specific positions, and it has been immensely useful in better understanding each other. So that's number one. Regarding your second question, I think that increasingly, especially over the past, I want to say 2 to 3 years, many participants on the Chinese side have been very, very optimistic about developing a dialogue at track one, at the official level. And in fact, I met with a few experts over the past couple of days, and we discussed about the possibility of doing dialogue at track one, at the official level. And all of them, every single expert that I met, said that they have been pushing for dialogue to actually take place. And I think it's a good thing. I think that they increasingly realize that this is something that needs to happen, that the relationship is mature enough that we can engage at track one. And now it's really up to the Chinese leadership to do that. One of the main concerns that traditionally the Chinese side has had in engaging in dialogue has been that the United States has a much bigger arsenal than China. And also it has much more experience in engaging in nuclear dialogue on transparency, arms controls, confidence building measures, because it's been doing that since the Cold War years with the Soviet Union and then Russia. And so China, which has a much smaller arsenal and just frankly less experience in dealing with those issues, has been reluctant in engaging in such dialogue. But my own sense, talking to experts and being involved in that track 1.5 process, is that we are getting closer and closer to a point where we could see engagement in nuclear dialogue actually take place. And I think the track 1.5 that the Pacific Forum has been leading could actually help support that process. And, you know, we could maybe even engage in drafting an agenda for track one. And so I'm cautiously optimistic. This is, I think, how I'll put it, on at least the nuclear track. I think more generally, the U.S.-China relationship is in trouble on several fronts. You know, trade, obviously. North Korea is, you know, an issue, obviously. Taiwan is another. South China Sea. But when it comes to nuclear issues, despite the fact that the Nuclear Posture Review features China as one of the two major powers that it needs to, you know, compete with, I think there is a possibility that the Chinese leadership sees a role for dialogue, so that at least that aspect of the relationship is properly managed. Again, this is me being cautiously optimistic. It may not happen, but my discussions suggest that it could.
Fair enough. I guess, you know, U.S.-China nuclear relationship is not just a matter between Washington and Beijing, because other players, including American allies, also play some role. As we know, some U.S. allies, especially Japan, is a little concerned about the so-called stability-instability paradox, meaning if the U.S.-China nuclear relationship is stable, there is no real risk of conventional conflict easily escalating to the nuclear level, then China might be emboldened to be more aggressive at the conventional military level, and therefore engaging in more threatening behavior towards Japan. So for a long time, you know, Japan is implicitly worried about, you know, U.S.-China explicitly committing to mutual strategic stability relationship. And I also know at Pacific Forum, you have also organized a lot of unofficial dialogues between the United States and its allies, U.S., South Korea, U.S., Japan, and U.S., South Korea, Japan trilateral meetings. Do you think, you know, in order to address the potential negative impact from U.S. allies to the U.S.-China bilateral nuclear relationship, any thought given to maybe, you know, some direct meetings or dialogues between China and the U.S. allies should take place.
So I guess right now in 2018, discussions between the United States and its regional allies, and frankly, we're talking mostly about Japan and South Korea. Most of the discussions have been focusing on the North Korea problem. And about 2 weeks ago, we held, the Pacific Forum held a US, Japan, South Korea extended deterrence dialogue at the track 1.5 level. And the focus was really North Korea. How do we think about the whole symmetry approach that just took place in the spring? Where do we want to go? And also, if there's a military crisis, how do we respond? How do we coordinate and cooperate to make sure that we respond properly? So, and when it comes to China, the focus has been mostly about the focus has been what role should or could China play in the event of a collapse of North Korea or something that would require Chinese participation. Mm. I think that there is an interest, particularly from Japan, in discussing broader strategic issues when it comes to the U.S.-China relationship and the relationship that regional allies should have with China. But because of the current news, most of the focus has been on North Korea.
Mm.
But yes, I see a role in China engaging in Japan and South Korea and maybe the two of them together as well.
Yeah, I think there is a real likelihood that some similar incidents or disputes like the THAAD dispute could happen in the near-term future. Japan has decided to introduce the long-range discrimination radar from the United States, and that has already caused some serious Chinese concern here. So maybe some dialogues there could help prevent another THAAD dispute from emerging. Well, given that we are talking about North Korea, and also I know you have spent a lot of time studying European security, so I always wonder, can we apply some of the European experience to addressing the Korean peninsula security challenges? My understanding is the North Korean's nuclear capability is likely to stay for a long time. With that said, there might be fertile areas for progress, especially in the area of conventional military arms control, confidence building measures between the two Koreas and also between maybe North Korea and the United States. Because North Korea now feels safe given it has already possessed a rudimentary nuclear deterrent capability, and therefore it might reduce its dependence on conventional military power. And therefore, I think that's a particular area of possible progress. In this regard, the European countries have a lot of experience in conventional military confidence building measures. Do you think any of these lessons can be applied to the Korean Peninsula? One example that came to my mind is the Open Skies Treaty. The reason I thought about this was, one driver of North Korean paranoia and driver to its nuclear development is the North Korean concern about a sudden preemptive military strike from the United States and South Korea to disarm North Korea, to decapitate its leadership. But maybe if we can do something similar to the Open Skies Treaty and let the North Koreans be able to monitor military mobilization in South Korea, that could help North Korea understand that, if there is any major military mobilization, it can quickly detect and therefore be prepared. So maybe that can help reassure North Korea and also help North Korea avoid adopting destabilizing nuclear postures, right? If North Korea feels safe from sudden preemptive military disarming strike, maybe it will forgo putting its nuclear weapons on high alert, even at peacetime, and it might forgo the option of pre-delegating nuclear launch authorities to lower their officials, and all these can help prevent incidental and or unauthorized nuclear launches from North Korea. So do you think any of such ideas might work on the Korean Peninsula?
I mean, I think, so I have never heard that specific proposal. I think it's interesting. I would have to give some thought to it. I mean, the Open Sky Treaty's approach, I really need to look into it a little more. My own sense is, yes, I'm sure there are lessons that can be learned on what we could do on the Korean Peninsula. And, you know, even the CFE treaty might give some, the Conventional Forces in Europe treaty, what was done could help inform specific actions we could take on the Korean Peninsula. But I think we are still quite a ways away from going down that road. I think that, like you said, I'm of the belief that the current North Korean arsenal, and I'm talking general arsenal, nuclear missiles, and of course, as you know, North Korea also has chemical and biological weapons and you know, conventional power. I think we, you know, that arsenal is here to stay. We will probably engage in some forms of, you know, some form of, you know, confidence building measures and maybe some reduction here and there, but that program is here to stay for the foreseeable future. I mean, we are in to stay engaged with North Korea on other issues, and we've already seen North Korea, for instance, the remains were sent, remains of U.S. soldiers were sent back to the United States. These forms of opening or forward leaning actions have been taken. But nothing has been really done to change the arsenal of North Korea specifically. So how do we move forward from here? I really don't know. And I don't see much of an appetite to move forward just yet. Mm. And my own sense, looking at what the US administration has been doing, is that... it's really been refocusing its attention to China more so than to North Korea right now. Yeah. And the more I think about it, the more I think it's difficult for the administration to focus on North Korea and to focus on one without focusing on the other.
Well, thank you so much, David. This is very interesting. I really appreciate you coming here and sharing your thoughts and insight with us today. But before you go, I also want to mention that at Pacific Forum, you have this wonderful Young Leaders Program in which you invite young scholars, emerging experts from all over the world to join important senior policy meetings, conferences, and most of the activities are paid. So those are free for young leaders to take part in. Personally, I have benefited a lot from that experience. I was a young leader, but recently was kicked out as I grow old. But I do want to encourage, you know, Chinese young students, scholars, experts who are interested in international and regional security issues, foreign policy issues, to apply and to actively participate in this wonderful program. So thank you again, David.
Thank you so much for having me.